This episode of The Line is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek.fm at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Tracks on the Line, the show on Trek FM, where we provide audio commentary for episodes of Star Trek Picard. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And we don't have any episodes of Star Trek Picard to record audio commentary for yet.
It is agonizing waiting. It's so far.
It is. That's true. That's true. I'm guessing that maybe by Saturday, October 5th, we'll have an idea of exactly how far away it is. But it's getting closer. And in the meantime, we're going to take a look at some episodes which are relevant to Star Trek Picard. And this week in particular, we're going to be taking a look at Season 4, Episode 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation, The Best of Both Worlds. Part 2.
Yep, the second one. The one that killed me waiting for it. Just like Picard, waiting for this drove me completely insane.
It's kind of like the first episode of Star Trek Picard is your Best of Both Worlds Part 2, Part 2.
Okay.
So, we got a message from a listener, Simon, who has some questions about time travel. In particular, he sent us a link to a YouTube video called Time Travel in Fiction Rundown.
Yeah.
And it gives you a few time travel scenarios, and he wanted to know like how that video relates to the time travel in All Good Things.
Yes.
And he wanted to know if you might be able to explain that to listeners.
Well, in All Good Things, there's a little bit of a cheat because Q is involved. And when Q is involved, you can get around a lot of problems. But strictly speaking, it is depicting a version of time travel wherein changes in the past change the future, which would not be the sort of recursive, like almost superpositional state of the future as seen in movies like 12 Monkeys or The Time Traveler's Wife, where the past and the future are all, in a sense, set and have already occurred from an objective, non-linear point of view. From outside of time, you look at the universe and all of these events occurred. All Good Things doesn't work that way because events in one point can affect the future and make it a different future than it was before. And the anti-time anomaly, by pushing through time backwards, reverting things, creates an alternate timeline in which no life exists in the universe. So that's a big deal. And that's a different timeline than the one that we see in Star Trek and in, you know, everyday life, because there's no anti-time anomaly working its way backwards to us. So it's a thing, it's an alternate timeline. But like, there is also this other aspect to it, which is the multiple timelines are intersecting in some way. They are all in the same space. So when all these different realities are all interacting on the on the subspace plane of existence that is a Star Trek made-up concept. It is affecting the entire universe retroactively, making the anti-time anomaly possible. I mean, it gets into some weird, like, hippy-dippy kind of thing where all of these different realities are potentially real. And but, I mean, like, Star Trek is a potential reality, so, like, it still kind of works, but you've also got to do a little fourth wall action to make it make sense. So... yeah, it's an alternate timeline, but it also has a little bit of the fixed timeline nonsense because Q is involved.
Okay, all right. Well, hopefully that helps. Hopefully that makes sense to some listeners. I'm not sure that it makes sense to me, but whatever. Let's just go with it.
If I come across a version of time travel in fiction that, like, really, really works, I point it out, and so far, there are very few.
I know you said, like, 12 Monkeys is a pretty good one.
12 Monkeys is a really good depiction of time travel from, like, a particular type of time travel. Like, a more nuanced, like, more expanded version of time travel you don't really see anywhere. The fixed timeline... can be done relatively easily. You just have to, like, make it all make sense if you put it into a linear progression. Just okay. Don't show it from the time traveler's point of view. Show it from the universe's point of view and let the audience figure out how it works from the time traveler's point of view. That mm-hmm. works. That's a good way of doing it. As long as what the time traveler's point of view is also makes sense, it still works. And almost always, people telling these stories, it fails on one of those levels. It either fails on the linear level or it fails on the time traveler's level.
Well, cool. Well, how about we talk about something that doesn't have any time travel in it this week?
Yeah, let's talk about something that has the Borg in it,
yeah.
Who also do time travel stuff.
They do. But we'll get to that time travel stuff later on. You know, we don't think you're getting out of this without talking about Star Trek First Contact. I mean, maybe we'll avoid it because, you know, because now we have a lot more stuff to talk about, but don't count on it. So, Star Trek, The Next Generation, The Best of Both Worlds, Part 2. We're going to provide audio commentary for it. Go on to Netflix or Amazon Prime or CBS All Access or whatever other streaming service you use. And go to zero on the counter for Best of Both Worlds Part 2. Mm-hmm. And get ready to start it up with us in 3, 2, 1, start. Okay.
It was the Enterprise ship.
Yep, last time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Oh, this is bananas. I have never watched this without hitting skip recap.
I hit skip recap in the analog broadcast way back when I first saw this, and I guess it was 1993, because they didn't show it, because the first time I saw this was part of the Viewer's Choice Marathon on WPWR Power 50, and episodes 2 and 1, counting down on the top 10, were Best of Both Worlds parts 1 and 2. Would have been weird if, you know, part 1 was number 1 and part 2 was number 2. I wonder what they would have done in that case.
Well, if they had any integrity, they would have aired it in that order.
I have a feeling that's how it actually went down or whatever, but of course that's not going to happen. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Point being, they decided, instead of saying last time on Star Trek The Next Generation, they said, here's a commercial for Solozzi Edelson Chevrolet, where you always save more money. There's someone in Chicago right now who's like, yeah. Everybody else is like, what's wrong with these people? So yeah,
the Star Wars holiday special had the same thing where people for years watched it, and there were commercials for Chicago businesses because it was recorded from a Chicago source.
That's awesome. So, Mr. Worf, fire. You know what's interesting? here.
Is the thing that you're about to say that they built up this moment for an entire summer and then they do it and it's nothing?
Yeah, no. I that is definitely something which I've thought of. That's not what I was going to say, but we can talk about that. I mean, it is kind of a crazy thing. It's actually something which people have criticized The Last Jedi for quite a bit, where they're like, the whole Finn and Rose storyline is them trying to do this thing, and they're going, and they spend like half the movie on this like adventure to do this thing, and then they get to the end and they fail, right? And it's like, well, okay. And everyone's like, well, why did we spend all this time doing that thing? But it's not about the destination. It's about the journey. To the journey.
No, it's about the destination. And the destination is failure. And failure is important.
Well, yeah, there's that too. I mean, and that's certainly, like, I don't think that that's what they were doing in Last Jedi necessarily. But here, it is very important. You know, I just watched The Shining a couple days ago, and that's one of the things which always strikes me about that movie, is there's the whole storyline with Scatman Crothers, where he's like, oh my God, this kid's in trouble, I have to go save this kid, and we follow him as he goes from Florida all the way up to Colorado, like stops, like convinces someone to give him a snow cat. He goes up the mountain, you know, and it's like this ticking clock, like he needs to get there before something bad happens. And then like he sets foot in the lobby and is like, hello. And then Jack Nicholson, like, you know, swings an axe into his chest and that's it. You know, I mean, like literally he got there and was like, hello. And then boom, he's dead.
I believe to this day, it has not been confirmed by any of his comments, but I do believe that that is the main reason that Stephen King doesn't like the movie.
You think so? Okay.
Because he has said many times he does not like the movie.
Yeah.
And so much of the movie is so right and gets so much of the book right. And that one critical change, I think, is a deal breaker for him.
Yeah. Okay.
And like he even shows up in the book in Dr. Sleep. So like he's like, I really wanted him to survive, guys.
Yeah.
Like I know you all saw the movie and read the book second, but like he's supposed to be alive.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just speaking of alternate realities and stuff. I mean, it is really interesting with like Dr. Sleep, the movie coming out, because, you know, they've talked to the director about walking that fine line of basically satisfying both Stephen King and Stanley Kubrick, you know, in the abstract. Yeah, it's not possible.
They've explicitly like made it very clear they are not servicing the book.
But and like, yet
Stephen King, the Overlook Hotel is there. The Overlook Hotel exists in the movie. It's blown up in the book.
And yet Stephen King endorses it. I mean, like just before the screening of The Shining that I saw, there was the director sitting next to Stephen King and they're like, hey guys, Dr. Sleep, coming November 15th. Buy your tickets on October 25th. It's November 8th. Sorry about that. Buy your tickets on October 25th and, you know, something like that. So, yeah, whatever.
Well, I think the moral of the story is that when you're as rich as Stephen King, you can have beef with things that made you super wealthy.
Perhaps. Speaking of which, Best of Both Worlds Part 2. I don't know what that has to do with that, but whatever.
It's the same thing. It's the exact same thing. This is The Shining of Star Trek. I'll think of why it works later.
Yeah. No, but so getting back to that idea of like he fails, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Mr. Worf, fire. And it's like, what? Is he going to die and everything like that? Like, that's the question. Is Picard coming back? You know, I mean, thinking about it on a level beyond just, of course, Picard is coming back, assuming that they can work out contract stuff. Like, they're not going to kill him right there, right? I mean, because we're only halfway through this story, right? I mean, like, when you step back, I mean, when you're watching it, you're like, oh my God, what's going to happen? But then when you step back and think about it, it's like, well, of course, there needs to be some complicating events, right?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. There's so much in this episode. There's so much going on that, like, I can't stop thinking about all of the things that I have thought about this episode over the years. And there's this speech that this admiral gives, and at one point he's like, there was a freshman in the academy and he ran this thing and it was the greatest thing I ever saw and his abs were amazing and he looked incredible without a shirt, and my God, Picard is a handsome man and such a gifted captain, and he would never assist the Borg, and he would kiss me if I asked nicely, and like, it's just like, what is going on here, guys? We're on board for Picard being great. Mm-hmm. Like this is a weird beat to take. Like, and then there's this thing where they turn off his skin pigmentation somehow.
No, but see, like, I like,
you
know, that.
You get
That's
your
cool.
skin pigmentation, like, let's turn your off your skin pigmentation.
Yeah.
And he uses a little flashing doodad that makes your arm stick up. Like, there's so much weird stuff going on.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so
weird. No, there is a lot of weird stuff going on. I mean, I was thinking about the idea of, like, is Picard coming back? Like, when you think about it, there's as much a question of, like, is Riker coming back? Like it almost seems like there's less a chance of that happening, because it's like, okay, you're captain. So now you're just going to be like, I don't want to be captain anymore. I mean, I was, and that always bothered me. Like, why is he not a captain still? I mean, in Star Trek II, right? Kirk takes over the Enterprise.
He does.
And Spock was the captain. And then once they get all that sorted out and they demote Kirk in Star Trek IV, spoilers, and he becomes captain of the Enterprise.
Really?
Yeah.
No. You're not just going to blow by that. You can't give a spoiler alert for something that happened when this show started.
Okay, I was just making a joke. Anyway, you know, Spock is still captain, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, Riker should still be captain at this point.
I have no problem with Riker being captain. I have no problem with any of the, like, I don't understand why there's all this concern about it. Like, to me, if I was in Riker's position and someone offered me my captaincy on another ship, I'd be like, I get to hang out with Picard.
I mean, I guess, but at the same time, you know, I can see you moving forward.
No, not me.
Okay. All right.
Maybe that's just me. Maybe that's just like my love for Picard. he's like a space dad. Just want a good space dad.
But if you just think about, like, Riker's arc here, right? The whole idea.
Riker's arc in this episode is, I'm going to be such a good captain, I never have to do it again.
Well, maybe that's what it is, you know? But, I mean, what it feels like, though, is like,
He's like a cleaning person who comes into your house and is like, I'm going to clean this place so good that you're never going to be able to get it messy again.
I mean, maybe that's what it is. But, you know, like, the way that it plays out, it really feels like, oh, you know, people think I should be captain. I'm doubting myself. I don't know why I should do this. I don't know if I want to do this. You know, I don't know if I can live up to Picard.
Well, of course you can't. You can't do that freshman mile running thing with those abs. I don't know what the guy said. I don't remember all the things he said. But he said a lot of flattering things about a very young Picard. And it was kind of like he was like going, this guy was so great.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I miss him.
But then, like, you know, Riker is like, oh, here it is. Look at me. I can step up to the streets and do this and be a good captain and all the rest of it. And then he is. And it's like, wow, he did something that Picard couldn't do, right? Like, he was the absolute best. I mean, so much so that in the episode, they're like, you could get any command you want at this point, you know, you'll have your choice of ships. And he's like, yeah, I'm just going to stay here. And it's like, wait, why? What? Why? I mean, I know the real reason why, because, you know, this is Star Trek The Next Generation and Riker has to be the first officer and all that stuff. But And this scene always confused me because he's like, Worf, I seriously considered you, but I need you at your post now. And it's like, Data, I seriously considered you, but I can't, you know. And that's weird for a couple of reasons. One, Worf's only a lieutenant, right? So why would he jump over, especially when Data is, you know, second in command on the ship now, right? So I can totally see having that conversation with Data. Why would you have it with Worf? And then Geordi is sitting over here. I mean, I wouldn't want to make Geordi my first officer either, but he outranks Worf, you know?
This is such a weird thing. Why would you invite them all to the room? Hey, weird everybody, too. just FYI, none of y'all's got the job.
Yeah. Whatever. But
all y'all staying where you are, except for her.
Yeah.
That's what's up.
But
you can go back to work now.
Yes. Yeah. It's a weird scene, but whatever.
It's a very weird scene.
But getting back to the thing that I found strange about that, you know, Mr. Worf fire moment or whatever, is, you know, when the Blu-rays came out in order to, you know, because the $100 price tag on the season sets wasn't enough, they were like, you know what? Let's do another separate release where we include, both episodes edited together into one feature-length movie. And just in case that's not enticing enough for these people who just dropped
a pretty short feature,
$100, 90 minutes, whatever, we'll also include an exclusive audio commentary on this disc. Let it, I mean, CBS, like, they have the Ferengi code of commerce, like, down like that. They are Ferengi at heart.
The rules of acquisition?
The biggest lobes in the business and all the rest of it. Anyway.
Did we learn nothing from Deep Space Nine? It's not the lobes.
You know, they haven't remastered Deep Space Nine yet, so I guess they haven't had a chance to look at it in recent years.
That's probably what it is.
Yeah, anyway, is. So anyway, they released this Blu-ray set where they cut this into like a feature-length movie, and they actually showed it in theaters around the country. And then they realized that there was some sort of like guild thing that they were violating, and they never did it again. But they did do it that one time. And I guess they did it for like the season before too, or whatever. It doesn't matter. Anyway, so I saw it, and it's really interesting because it does not work nearly as well. Not even just the fact that you need that break. The way that the episode is structured, you have the music, you have everything, and then when you cut that out, it just becomes like another beat in the story. But all that
if you do it all in order, like Mr. Worf fire is like one moment, and in context, it doesn't feel significant. It feels like, yeah, of course you're going to fire, but there's this music thing and there's this push.
Yep.
It's all very like really, they're really pushing it to make it as dramatic as possible. And then when nothing happens, it just becomes this really awkward moment where then Picard comes up on screen and he's like, I know all your tricks, number one. Get it? Because I'm snarky now? Because the Borg have some snark circuitry up in their system now? Because I'm up in the mix? Because I'm Picard and I've got a little bit of a jokester side to me that doesn't come out very often.
Yeah, but it's there. You know how snarky Picard is in general.
A lot going on in that one line. And it's just like, it's not good. It doesn't work. It's like Star Trek Next Generation definitely like was... it was shot and edited with the language of television, and outside of that context, it's just weird.
Yeah, no, it is weird. It doesn't really work. And also, like, you miss out. I mean, that music sting is probably, like, the most famous piece of music in Star Trek The Next Generation outside of the theme, right?
Yeah, there should at the very least be like an intermission.
Yeah.
You know, there should be an intermission.
Because it's only, where, yeah.
Where, like, you know, like Wesley comes out and goes like, hey, what's going on?
I was really disappointed with that. I mean, they did it for like a bunch of the cliffhangers and stuff, edited them into, you know, feature length things. And then they did it for All Good Things as well. They released that separately, even though that already is. But they're like, we've edited it into like a feature length film. And I'm like, wow. You know, and when you say like edit it, I'm thinking like they went through, they took out like the fades to black at the commercials, they smoothed out the audio. Who knows? Maybe there's an extra scene here or there that like the directors or the writers would want, you know, back in place or whatever. But no, they literally just took out the credits and like cut the two. But if you're going to do that, go all the way, you know, just do it for real and actually make it like a movie. Because here you're still fading to black every 8 minutes. It's like, what are you doing here? I mean, if you're going to do that, actually do it. Oh, I think,
did we miss Jennifer's death?
Oh, yeah, we did, right? Because we're in Wolf 359 now. We saw the Star Trek V god guy die. And, now we're at Wolf 359. That woman in the background who, you know, she wasn't turning around last episode either. She does finally turn around. But like everybody, you know, in the front section is like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Look at all the destruction. And she's like, you know, just still at her station, like whatever. And then well, maybe eventually she's got, she like, does turn around. But
yeah. She's got sensors and stuff. She's scanning and she's like, yeah, look at it. Wow. I've got a better angle than you guys. I'm like switching camera angles and everything. I'm doing zooms. Yeah,
maybe that's what
you guys
is.
Don't even do zooms where you are.
Yeah, no, that's true. But,
I find it weird that the Borg have a view screen, and I find it crazy weird that view screen rotates.
They're
is the idea so that all the Borg get to see the view screen? And so, like, Borg on one side of the ship are like, what is he seeing?
Yeah, yeah. It is kind of strange.
I get it. There's a lot of weird going on, man.
Yep.
Oh. Yep. So much is happening. Battle Bridge.
You know, it's weird because it is such like a short period of time for like, you know, these episodes, only 45 minutes. And the first episode was a lot of like setup and waiting and everything. But, you know, we don't see Picard as Locutus until like the last scene of part one. And now, you know, we think of like this is the one where he's like, he's Locutus. But really, like you look at the time, I mean, they're about to go grab him now. Like, he's only on the Borg ship for, like, maximum, like, 20 minutes of screen time, right? Or, well, I guess a little bit more than that, because we're at 20 minutes and 28 seconds now. But, you know, you take out, like, all the stuff. Oh, there's a shot that they weren't able to find in HD. Anyway.
It's supposed to be, like, what, like, 3 days or something? Like, some...
Well, I think, yeah, because they had to go to Wolf 359 and everything there.
Yeah, and they were stuck for a bit.
Yeah.
And then they had to go. And, like, so, like, it is a period, there is a chunk of time there. And so, yeah, obviously it's a big deal. But, like, on screen, it doesn't feel like a big deal.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like we think about it as, like, this is the one where he's Locutus and he's, you know, whatever. But, like,
really?
in a 90-minute episode, he's only, like, on that Borg ship as a Borg for like 20 minutes.
I mean, I'm actually wondering like what you mean by that, because when I think of Best of Both Worlds Part 2, the thing I think of is Picard is shirtless with some tubes sticking out of him and he's holding Data's arm and he says sleep.
That's what you think. I think
Crusher says he must be exhausted. And I say, what is wrong with you, Beverly? That was a stupid thing to say.
She was playing the role of the audience, you know?
It was a stupid thing to say. I'm so disappointed in Beverly Crusher.
I don't think you have to be disappointed in Beverly Crusher. I think you have to be disappointed in the writers, you know?
Which, I can be disappointed in a lot of things simultaneously.
Speaking of which, you know, I
am the Borg of being disappointed in things.
I do love the fact that this episode is written and directed by the same people as part one. You know, that it has that continuity. I actually did a thing in my senior year of high school where I was taking an independent study in film criticism. And hang on, let me stop for 1 second to point out how cool this shot of the two of them in the cockpit is with the green screen stuff on the outside there. Like, you could do like an effect shot showing this shuttle flying to the thing, which is what they normally do, but by putting it in there and doing it all Star Tours like, it is it is so much more effective. It gives it such a larger feel, you know, by showing less. It's like, wow, this ship is actually flying, and the angle that they use and everything is perfect. Anyway, so I took this independent study on, like,
I agree, they did this on the original Battlestar Galactica very well, and they did it like on most space shows as much as possible. Well, and Star Trek has a history of not doing it, and it's kind of a thing.
I only watched like 3 episodes of the original Battlestar Galactica because I hate to break this to anyone, but it's bad. Anyway.
Well, here's the thing. You should have been watching it when you were a small child, and you and it having spaceships shooting at each other was enough.
Okay. All right. Well, regardless of that. So when I took this independent study in senior year of high school, I did an exercise examining like the role that a director plays, you know. And what I did was I looked at Chain of Command parts 1 and 2, which were directed by 2 different people, and talked about how stylistically they were different. And it is kind of insane how, I forget who directed part 1. Part 2 was directed by, what's the guy's name? 2 L's. Lou something?
I don't know. L.L. Bean.
Yeah. Anyway.
He also makes clothes.
Part 2 is substantially better directed than part 1. And it's really interesting because you can totally see the difference there. But with this one, you know, it's parts 1 and 2.
5 are lights worth of difference.
Yeah, there you go. Parts 1 and 2 were both written by Michael Piller and both directed by Cliff Bull. And I love that consistency. You know, the idea that you could edit them together into one feature length movie if you wanted to do it like for real, you know.
Yeah, I mean, like, to be fair, like, Star Trek The Next Generation, there are very few episodes that depart significantly stylistically from each other.
That's definitely true. Like, you almost can't tell the difference. But when you're looking like, for it most, in order to write a paper on it, you know, then you can see the differences. Yeah. You know,
most of these you could cut together and, you know, you wouldn't notice a stylistic difference.
Right. Like, here, he's already back now. We're only 25 minutes into this episode, so
whatever. Yeah, and we're coming up on the thing that I remember from this episode most, because most of the episode, like, my memory of this episode is Picard in this tube thing that they keep reusing over and over again on the show, and then in other shows, because this one set and this prop keep popping up, and it's frustrating. But like, that's what I remember. I remember Picard in the tube saying a few words, and that's it.
I mean, I remember that, but the thing that I think of more than anything, I think, is just the scene that we just saw where they go and they rescue Picard. And I, because of that, like, I always thought, like, well, this is the better of the two, right? Because there's, because of that, you know, because there's so much cool stuff going on there. But it's interesting that, you know, like, looking at it, I mean, people do tend to think of it as just one thing, but when you break it down, people are like, well, part one is better than part two. And I mean, that might maybe true. I didn't think of that at the time. I was more into part two, I think, because there was the buildup from part one and everything. But, you know, this is much more action oriented and stuff like that.
Also, there are explosions,
right? And, exactly,
and like ships getting blown up, and
yeah,
like a whole bunch of people in a list of casualties that includes Sisko's wife. I mean, like, I guess that's interesting. I don't know. I don't care which one's better. It doesn't mean anything to me.
Right. And no, it doesn't really. But, I mean, it really is in terms of, like, the action and everything. I mean, like, Best of Both Worlds Part 1 is the Kill Bill Volume 2 of Best of Both Worlds, and Best of Both Worlds Part 2 is the Kill Bill Volume 1 of Best of Both Worlds.
Oh my god, there could not have been a comparison that was more boring than that.
Alright, whatever. Anyway, but yeah, I mean, like, this stuff is kind of, you know, I mean, like, once you do get Picard just kind of, like, sitting here on the ship, it is kind of like, and it's weird. Like, I did just go see the motion picture in theaters a couple weeks ago, and there is a lot of similarity between this and, you know, Ilia or V'ger. Is it V'ger? Is that what they call the thing?
V'ger is the alien.
But what do they call the probe? Is it, I don't know, whatever. Whatever they call the probe thing. Is it V'ger? I guess. I don't know.
Yes. What are you talking
about? I mean like the Ilia probe with the light on her neck and stuff like that. Do they call the probe V'ger? Doesn't matter.
I don't remember what they called Ilia when she was possessed by the probe.
But it's not Ilia, it's a robot it doesn't matter. Anyway.
Never.
Yeah, so that's that. Anyway.
None of this matters.
Yeah. So we just had that scene, and this always freaks me out, but the scene where they're examining Picard for the first time, and he's got his laser on still, and you can see the laser, like, pointing into Crusher's hair, and I keep on thinking, like, geez, if they're not careful, like, they're going to blind Gates McFadden, you know? Like, that could very easily go into her eye, and that freaks me out.
You can get a laser pointer in your eye. It doesn't blind you. It's
thing. But let's remember that this is back in the early 90s, and those lasers were a lot stronger back then. I'm pretty sure.
No.
I'm pretty sure. There was a kid who brought a laser into class, which it was, everyone's like, oh my god, those things are like $300. And he brought a laser pointer into class, and then, like, some kids were, like, staring into it, and I'm like, this is not, why are you guys doing this? This is bad.
And now they're just cat toys.
Exactly, right? you can go, I mean, like, that's seriously true. If I was like, I need a laser pointer, like, and I had to think of, like, I need to go to a store to buy a laser pointer, the place I would go is Petco.
Like, if I needed a laser pointer, I would just dig through my drawers, because I have so many freaking laser pointers lying around.
My cat,
some of them are just, like, given away at offices with, like they're just, like, part of a pen, and it's like, hey, you ever need to use a laser pointer with your pen? And I'm like, no, it's never come up, but now I'm all set.
My cat used to love that so much. You'd hear the little jingle of the thing, and he'd be like, what's going on? Where is it? And it got to the point where I had to, like, hide it, because he would just get too hyper. But now that he's older, I think I might get him another laser pointer and see what he does with it, see what he thinks.
He'll still go for it.
Yeah.
He'll still go for it. Like, I busted out the laser pointer just to see what would happen with my cats, and it's been years, and one of them has always been, like, jump across the wall to try to catch it. Like, if there were a bunch of Borg in the place, she would not be interested in the Borg at all. She would be going after those red dots.
Yeah, can you imagine, like, Spot with the Borg? I mean, that would be, like, inappropriately comic for an episode, but at the same time, like, extremely realistic.
I mean, in my head, what I'm imagining is the greatest scene in Star Trek history. Yeah. It's like 10 Borg in a room trying to catch Spot. And Spot is just zipping around the corners and walls and jumping off of them, trying to catch that red dot. But there are so many red dots.
Yeah.
He doesn't know where to go. So he tries to go in all directions simultaneously and they can't catch him. And they're like, we're just trying to assimilate a cat. Guys, maybe this isn't worth the effort. Maybe we just let this cat go. And then they try to leave, and the cat follows them out the door because it's following the red dot. And I'm like, guys, why isn't this the whole show?
Yeah. That sounds like a good Lower Decks episode, if you ask me. Guess we'll see.
Oh, that would be amazing.
So Brian here is here. He's getting to help out. You know, that's cool.
It's always good when O'Brien gets to do something on this show because we know how capable he is on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
And it's always funny how often O'Brien isn't able to accomplish things on this show because he hasn't had the chance to be on Deep Space Nine yet.
Yep.
He doesn't have the self-confidence that he acquires in the pilot of Deep Space Nine.
Mm-hmm. So here is the thing where they're like, it is confirmed the Borg have broken through the Mars defense perimeter. And people are always like, oh, the Mars defense perimeter, you know, because it's like those three ships that just fly and they're like, boop, 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 and then they're gone. Right. And I guess my question, and this is sort of like the big question, which I don't know if it's ever been answered, but were those ships manned? Because if they were, that's pretty brutal. I mean, those are like, you know, a bunch of people who are like, we are, because, you know, the way that Worf says, like, it's confirmed they've broken through the perimeter. Like, those are three people who are like, we are totally following protocol, even though we know that we are going to die. You know, I mean, that's like something, I mean, obviously that happens all the time in war. Right. But I mean, it's pretty brutal. Like, I guess I always assumed that there were people flying those things, and it's not, I mean, part of it is that they get wiped out so easily, right? But the thing that really hits the nail on the head for me is when Worf is like, it is confirmed, as if they were like, well, we're going to send out the Mars defense perimeter and they are all going to be destroyed in seconds. But we're going to do it anyway. And then Worf's like, confirmed, you know? I mean, it's just kind of like in a similar way to, you know, when they're like, oh, confirmed, you know, the Spider-Man is going to be in Avengers. And it's like, well, we knew that he was going to be in Avengers, you know, but now it's confirmed. Okay.
Yeah. These are the same.
I'm just saying there's a certain amount of like brutality there, which really it freaks me out, you know. But
I agree. I mean, like in my mind, like the way that this progressed, it was like, this is the worst case scenario. We're going to be seeing, you know, red dots blip off of our screen a lot until this is over. Like, this is going to be a brutal slog. They're going to be wiping out people all over the place. And also, in my mind, those ships were definitely manned.
I mean, it is kind of cool how, like, I mean, this is obviously, like, one of the defining moments of the 24th century for humanity, right? I mean, this is
the one time the Borg almost killed everyone on Earth.
No,
oh, no, wait, it happened a second time.
but the second time, I don't know, maybe it's just because it was the movie and, you know, people don't really, but, you know, but this is the one where it's like, you know, you talk about like the Battle of Wolf 359 and everything like that. Like, this is big. And I do love how you see how it impacts people like throughout the rest of the franchise, you know? I mean, even though all of these stories were told like pre-9/11, like they did a really good job of sort of like accurately depicting. I mean, maybe it would be the equivalent at the time would be like Pearl Harbor or something like that, right? Like something that, but like you see like, well, you see the battle from the perspective of Sisko's ship in the pilot for Deep Space Nine. You know, there's another thing where I forget what the episode was, but they're like talking about, you know, like safety or whatever, and, you know, whether or not you're safe or something like that. And, you know, Bashir is like, I was on Earth, you know, when the Borg invaded, you know, and you're never say like we were all like, well, this is it, you know, and I just love that the way that like over the years in the franchise and various places, which are, you know, pretty much unrelated, they're able to add texture to what happens in this episode, because this episode is like one of the most significant events, not only for these characters that we're watching, but for the entire Federation, you know, in the entire history of Star Trek.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think that what they were going for was, like, this would be a thing that would happen in history. And, like, when you have, a connected universe, I mean, this is, like, the big, like, expanded universe of interconnected stories and characters that, you know, presage the cinematic version of this, but it existed in comic books. But like the model is like major events are referenced by people years later. Like this is a major event because it happened near a bunch of things that people talk about on a regular basis. They were near Earth, so Earth is a part of the story. People are on Earth. If you're going to mention big things that happen, you're going to have to, because it's a big thing that happened. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to have like a big traumatic event, you have to have a character be killed off dramatically. Like this is where you set that, because this is a big dramatic event that happened, and it puts that event in the history of the universe that we know. It grounds it in a way. Which is why, I mean, obviously Jennifer was going to die at Wolf 359, you know, because, like, she needed to be dead in order for Sisko to be a single father. So, like, she was kind of born to die at this moment, and this moment was sort of born to be a traumatic event for characters in the future. Like, it's world building, it's interesting stuff.
Yeah.
It's complicated.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I imagine that that everyone was talking about this after it all went down. They were like, man, they got Picard back and stopped the Borg all in one thing. That's amazing. Who was the captain of that ship? Oh, Riker, the guy who refuses to leave Picard's side. Picard must be an amazing guy.
Yep.
Because the guy who stopped the Borg will not leave him for anything.
Yep.
I wonder how fast he can run. And what he looks like without a shirt.
Yep. Yeah, well.
So, oh, they're pretty good.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So, you know, but the other thing that I like about it is it's like, you know, here Riker's a good leader and everything like that, but at the same time, it is a team effort, right? Like, it's Data who figures out how to shut it down because...
Oh, yeah.
Because
absolutely.
Picard tells him to. Like, even Picard gets in on the action, right? But, yeah.
Like, they all play a role, you know? I mean... Worf is there to say, I'll shoot them.
No, but Worf saves Picard, right?
He does.
Yeah.
But, like they all do their thing. They all play a role. They all, like, participate in stopping the Borg.
Crusher, like, figures out the alternating thingies.
Like, let's be fair here. What they found was a major security flaw in the Borg's security software.
Yeah.
Like they found an exploit and they utilized it and it gave them a temporary advantage. And I'm sure that the Borg have updated their firmware and it's been patched and no one can pull this off again, except they do basically the same thing like five times on Voyager.
Yeah. Oh. In the HD, you can really see some of the imperfections in the set, you know, where things have been painted and stuff like that. And
this is the image in my head of this episode. It's just this.
Yeah.
It's just this.
Okay.
Data, Picard. Picard's got tubes. And for me, the thing that always pops out in the HD is the makeup and wardrobe, which I never noticed in standard definition, ever. No matter how many times people point out things that are ridiculous. I never noticed, like, the tackiness of sequins.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously it was never designed for anything of this resolution or anything like that. I mean, it's cool, like, from a, you know, film appreciation standpoint, where you can, like, kind of, like, really see, like, by seeing all of the seams, you know, it's kind of like when you see, like, a costume on display or something like that. You're like, wow, okay, so that's how they made it, you know? But in a sense, for dramatic purposes, it almost hurts things. But yeah, it is what it is. I mean, Robert Hewitt Wolf has made the argument that, like, Deep Space Nine shouldn't be remastered in HD because that's not how it was designed, you know?
Well, if RH Dub says it shouldn't be, I might be on his side.
Yeah, but then again, you know, you got Ira Steven Bear saying that he has vowed to not watch the show again until he can watch it in HD. So then again, you've also got...
Well, if Papa Bear is on board for the HD remaster, then I got to go with Papa Bear.
But then again, you've also got, you know, Ira Steven Bear along with, you know, Jonathan West, the cinematographer, saying, like, you know, converting it to 16 by 9... You know, that's a reasonable thing to do. We should probably do that.
Well, I'm not on board for Wild Wild West's idea to turn this into 16 by 9. I think that's bananas.
Well, I think it's a moot point because I don't think they're going to get the money to do it anytime soon. So, sorry, guys.
Boy. Well, what are you going to do?
But like I always say, like, being upset over not getting Deep Space Nine in HD is kind of unreasonable because the fact that we got Next Generation in HD is absolutely insane. It's insane. I don't think that people realize that. Like, when I first read about, like, the rumors that was happening, I was like, that's a bunch of BS. There's no way that they're going to do that because the amount of time, effort, money that would be involved with doing that is absolutely insane. It's just that's it's not something which is done. And then it happened, and it's a miracle that it happened. I have no idea how it happened still, right? I mean, just from a technical standpoint. So people complaining about Deep Space Nine not getting remastered in HD...
Are you addressing a beef that fans have that I'm not familiar with? Is there an outcry that I'm not aware of? Well,
there's an outcry that we haven't gotten Deep Space Nine in HD.
Is it like a fervent outcry or is it like a lamenting outcry?
I could see a lamenting outcry. Someone on Twitter posted a poll where they were like, "Which would you rather have, Deep Space Nine in HD, or a season 8 of Deep Space Nine? Which would you rather have?"
Yeah, and people obviously said season 8 of Deep Space Nine because that's much more important.
No. And I saw the results of that poll. I mean, it was pretty close to 50-50, but the HD remaster won, and I'm like, what is going on?
That tells you one thing for sure.
Star Trek fans are more interested in what they love than what they might love.
Paradoxically, Star Trek fans are somehow really into the past.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, that was Star Trek The Next Generation, Season 4, Episode 1. So yeah, okay, I think next time we should do iBorg.
Oh, I'm on board.
Okay. All right. I haven't seen that one too much. I'm excited to to rewatch that episode, especially now through this new lens.
Seen it a few times, seen it a number of times. Probably as many times as I've watched the entire show, because generally speaking, that's how I've seen it.
Well, I guess that makes sense. Yeah, I haven't watched the... I've watched the show all the way through once, when the DVDs came out.
I think for me, it's three or four times.
Mm-hmm.
And I've probably seen iBorg more than that. Because I have definitely watched Next Generation from beginning to end, like 10 times or so. But most of those times, I just straight up skip the first two seasons.
Yeah, yeah. That's not from beginning to end, then. That's from middle to end.
It is from beginning to end, though.
Okay, all right.
From beginning to end of, at the very least, like, the good uniforms.
Yeah. From beginning to end of the good uniforms. Yes. Okay. Well, you know, maybe we might be getting some. Well, who knows? Who knows what else we'll have time. I'm hoping that, you know, come Saturday we'll have a better idea of how many of these pre commentaries we can do, you know, and then we'll really start to map things out. But yeah, so
all I know is that I am very, very happy about any news about Picard.
Well,
so excited.
Well, hopefully on Saturday, October 5th, you'll be very, very happy because there should be some.
My wife is now caught up with Voyager, so she has a deep appreciation for Seven of Nine that at times is difficult for me to handle.
No, I mean, Seven of Nine saved that show. Seven of Nine is the best part of Voyager, hands down.
Sure. No, the Doctor's the best part of Voyager.
He's cool, but Seven of Nine is the best part. So,
For me, Seven of Nine's always going to be kind of a barrier. I have got an issue with Seven of Nine. I don't like that they brought her in to be the savior of the show. And I don't like that she's always in that freaking cat suit.
Well, you know, she's not going to be in... See, but that's the thing about it, right? Is it's like... When you look at it from like a commercial perspective, when you look at it from like a practical perspective, she was brought on the show for all the wrong reasons.
Yes.
And it is kind of crazy that she is the thing that made the show good.
It's frustrating to me. I find I know that I'm talking about myself here, but I find it difficult to square this particular problem because I don't like that she's on the show and I hate that she's amazing. Like, I don't like that they brought Seven of Nine on the show and it infuriates me that Jeri Ryan is incredible on that show.
It's the way that it works.
And when my wife said she's my favorite character in Star Trek.
I mean, it's Linus, let's be completely honest.
Jeez, man. You gotta let this go.
I can't.
Tilly kills Linus, man. Tilly's the best.
I know. Tilly is the best. But Linus is a close second. Yeah. Anyway. All right. So that's it for The Best of Both Worlds, part two. We'll be back next time with iBorg. But in the meantime, Max, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on the internet at jmaxhagel on Twitter and other places that I don't remember.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at mumbles3k and Letterboxd as well if you want to see what movies I've been watching, like The Shining. And you can also find me on thenerdparty.com. Doing a show called Retro Perspective, and you can find us both on filmdamagepod.com doing a show called Film Damage, and that's about it. All right, so until next time, Max, the line must be drawn where?
Right after you say Mr. Worf fire, apparently.